Hello everyone, today on the Bath Podcast, we are speaking with Farouk Anjoun. Farouk is a longtime teacher as well as builder who's worked on everything from the App Store to e-learning modules for Intro to Blockchain courses. This is a great episode and we go all over from how to use the Stacks blockchain to what his predictions are for 2023. But first, a word from our sponsors. The Blockchain Accelerator Foundation, also known as BAF, is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to accelerating the development and adoption of Web3. BAF hosts networking and educational meetups and supports blockchain clubs at universities worldwide. BAF's sponsors and supporters include NEAR and the Algorand Foundation, who help BAF launch more educational activities. For more information, visit the Blockchain Accelerator Foundation on Twitter. Are you sick of expensive classes that don't help you in today's competitive work environment? EduCoin was too. So we built a decentralized learning management system that allows any teacher to host an open access industry-sponsored class. If you're a teacher and want to learn more about how you can build the class of the future, or a student looking to grow your career, visit EduCoin.store to see how they are helping students, teachers, and employers connect to make a more healthy secondary education ecosystem. Hello, everyone. I am here today with Farouk Anjoun. He is a professor at Harrisburg University in Pennsylvania, and he is coming on the show today to talk all things education and blockchain. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jake. My pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Awesome. So tell the audience a little bit about yourself, Farouk, kind of what your background is and how you got into the world of Web3 and blockchain.
Sure. Happy to do that. So after getting my PhD, about 20 years back, I've been dabbling in various things, worked in research labs, worked in large companies like Qualcomm, whose technology is present in our iPhones, Android phones, etc. In fact, I worked on the first app store in the world, and then I was working for startups, working on my own startup called GrowGuru that was focused on irrigation management for farmers. And now I have been dabbling in crypto over the last 5 years. 2015, that's when I got my first exposure to Bitcoin. I've been dabbling in that, but I had my startup also, so I did not have much time. But over the last 2 years, nearly 2 years now, I've been dabbling nearly full time in the Web3 crypto space because I see the potential behind crypto, potential to build solutions for problems that cannot be solved using the existing technology. And also potential for crypto to be like a separate asset category for each one of you. By the way, I would like to point out, Jake, before I get into the details, that nothing I say on this should be considered as investment advice. Okay, I'm going to talk about my opinions and how I look at things, but I'm not an investment advisor. These are just my opinions. I'm sure
you like. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We'll put a little disclaimer in too that, of course, nothing said on this podcast should be taken as financial advice. So one thing I kind of want to peel back here, you said you were involved in the first app store. When was that? What was that? Was that Android? Was that iPhone's app store? Tell me a little bit about that project.
The first app store in the world was created by this company called Qualcomm. Okay. They had an app store that they called as Brew that used to work on several phones. I believe it was started in the early 2000, 2001, 2002, somewhere thereabouts. And their phones were working on the AT&T and Verizon networks. So you could download the apps. They were primitive apps, not as, of course, the devices themselves were quite primitive also those days. But still, you had the capability to download some of these applications and do various things, various simple things. That was the first app store, even before, much before the Apple App Store came into picture in late 2000s.
So you're saying this was early 2000?
Yeah, 2001, that's when I believe Brew started.
So
B-R-E-W, that was the name of the app.
Okay, sorry. How was this app store accessed? Was it a mobile app store? Was it done via your computer?
It was on your flip phones, devices, all those. It was on your devices. Verizon, AT&T were the gatekeepers, unlike Apple, who is the gatekeeper right now. And to get your apps into this app store, you had to go through Verizon, had to bless it for the Verizon phones, and AT&T had to bless it for their AT&T phones. And you could download the apps on your AT&T Verizon phones and do whatever those apps. Again, they were not as advanced apps as what you have now. They did not have GPS capabilities, all those other things. But at least the concept was there. Not many people know that Qualcomm was the first company that came out with the first app store, and I had a chance to work on that.
That's amazing. What was the number one thing you kind of learned from this app store? It clearly wasn't a huge commercial hit. I assume it had some users, but and maybe how can you extrapolate that to what's going on now in the Web3 and the crypto markets?
The usability. I mean, Qualcomm is quite good at technology. I'm an ex-Qualcomm employee, so I guess I can say that now without any of this one. Qualcomm is quite good at technology. I mean, it's been about 15 years now since I left them. I'm sure things have changed a lot. So I have not been following them as closely. But during those days, they were quite good at technology, but not as good as marketing it, not as good as marketing and taking advantage of the technology in terms of getting the technology into the hands of the users. So the usability was not great. And then Qualcomm had their own constraints. I'm not putting all the blame on Qualcomm. During those days, you had the Verizons and the AT&Ts of the world that were controlling the pipes and all that stuff. So they had to work through all those challenges. Apple does not have those challenges these days. And of course, Apple, with their whole iPhone being a completely different beast, they were able to get through the gatekeepers of those days, which was the Verizons and the AT&Ts. Of course, I'm sure Verizon doesn't like Apple being the gatekeeper for the iPhone. I'm sure Verizon would like to get the 30% cut that Apple gets. Verizon used to get the cuts along those lines in this first app store. They had I forget the margin numbers now. It's been a while. But these companies, so I could have created an app for this brew store, and I could have, I would have to get some permission from these big telcos, and the telcos would get their portion of the rent. That's how things were working before Apple came along and did whatever they did. And now Apple gets the rent, 30%.
Yeah. What was the most popular app you remember at the time? Like, is it anything that I would have heard of or anything similar to what we use now?
No, I need to go back. I've completely forgot. I think, I will have to pass on that question. I just can't remember. It's been 15 years.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. So let's kind of fast forward a little bit. You told me in 2015, you were started looking into Bitcoin and as well as investing maybe in the space. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Although the investment, I was not very much, that's a good question. I was aware of Bitcoin and all that. There was one mistake that I did in 2015, Jake. I was focused more on the technology of Bitcoin. I understood the blockchain concepts, how it worked. I started teaching some courses also related to Bitcoin. But one area that I did not focus on at that point in time was the economics aspect of it, was the relationship with the money aspect of it. That was one of the reasons why I dabbled a little bit, but then I did not go all in some sense, in terms of the investment of the money part of it. During those days, if you had talked to me, I would have said, Bitcoin is a great technology to build solutions, especially in areas where you cannot trust third parties. I understood that part of it, but it's the relationship to money that was not very clear until about 2 years back.
Wow. And, you know, you mentioned build on it. I remember in 2016 or 17, I looked into the Bitcoin blockchain for app development. I was trying to do something with telemedicine and trying to, you know, obviously provide anonymous support and payments for certain medical visits. And it just seemed a little premature. I guess, how did you see Bitcoin in that early time, you know, so in quote unquote early 2015, but how did you see it as a tool? How do you still even see it today as a tool for builders?
You know, Bitcoin, Bitcoin was the first application that came up with this whole concept of blockchains. But if you look at it, blockchains help you build solutions without requiring to trust any third party. Of course, Bitcoin does not have all the capabilities. Bitcoin does not support smart contracts and all of that stuff, right? So that's a challenge with Bitcoin that exists. We can argue about whether it's good for Bitcoin, whether it's bad for Bitcoin, stuff like that. That's a separate question. But still, the blockchain itself allows you to build solutions where you don't need to trust third parties. And that's good, actually, in for many instances, right? I mean, if you look at the field of finance, trusting third parties has not left us in a good state. The field of social media, trusting third parties has not left us in a good state. Field of gaming, trusting third parties has not left us in a good state. So we need technology that allows us to build solutions without requiring us to trust third parties. And Bitcoin was the first that proposed the technology. The bad thing, though, is now one had to take the next step to provide what are these days called as smart contracts on top of Bitcoin. Because smart contracts are the one that will allow you to build these solutions in the social media space, in the storage space, in the gaming space, etc. And that's something that did not happen on Bitcoin until recently. And now, even now recently, Bitcoin is not going to change, but people are looking at other ways to add this functionality on top of Bitcoin.
For sure. And you know, I think that you mentioned Stacks as something you're involved with. Is that kind of what the Stacks Foundation does, or kind of give us a little bit of brief on that?
Yeah, the approach behind Stacks, and I'm not involved with the Stacks Foundation or any of those official organizations, but I have studied Stacks, and the whole objective behind Stacks is to add to the functionality of Bitcoin without changing the basic Bitcoin protocol. And that indeed will make Bitcoin much more valuable. So right now, think about it. You buy, let's say, just for the sake of argument, you buy one Bitcoin, and that Bitcoin is just sitting there. And yeah, we have all these hodlers, as they like to call themselves, all well and good. But then what use is that Bitcoin? It's like the 1 kg of gold that you might have purchased. Okay. Yes, you are just waiting for the number go up, for the Bitcoin value to go up over a period of time. But what if you could use this to do various things? I mean, lend it out, earn some yields from the Bitcoin that is sitting out there, as well as use the Bitcoin to reward people who are doing the right thing in the social media space and all of that stuff. Those things, those type of use cases, Bitcoin cannot support them. That's where Stacks comes in. They are now trying to add this smart contract functionality, as I said earlier, without modifying Bitcoin.
Interesting. And you know, are you part of the development, you know, effort? Are you building with Stacks at all, or have you kind of gotten?
An external entity or an external party or whatever you want to call it. Not officially involved with Stacks, but I have seen their solutions, and we have built a platform called Leos, LEOS.guru, and this platform we are developing courses with hands-on verification. We started with Stacks first. We could have done with other blockchains also. So you see, the thing with blockchains is the operations of the blockchains are publicly visible, publicly accessible. So if I tell you to transfer some Bitcoin to me, transfer some STX, which is the token on Stacks, transfer some Ether to me, or if I ask you to mint an NFT on the Ethereum chain or on the Stacks chain or whatever have you, I can verify whether you have done it without having to manually check your work or manually look at it. I can have this verification done automatically. So it's the on-chain verification that can be done automatically. That is indeed what we have done on this Leos platform. So we are building this platform to help newbies understand the various blockchains. And again, as I said, we started with Stacks as the first blockchain. So if you go to leos.guru, there's a course on Stacks. And again, you can be absolute beginner, and then it will take you through what are called as wallets. How do you secure the wallets? How do you receive and send Stacks? It goes through all the details so that by the end of this course, by the way, the course consists of 8 modules. By the end of the course, you will have a decent understanding of how does Stacks work and how can you interact, send, receive, verify all your Stacks transactions. That's what this course does. So in that sense, we have been working in the Stacks ecosystem.
Yeah. And so tell me a little bit about Stacks. I guess kind of treat me like one of the students that could be on Leos. You know, is it considered a layer two? Is that a fair assumption of it or no?
Different people do call it differently, Jake. Okay. I like to call it as layer 1.5. Some might call it as layer one. Basically, what happens is Stacks is a blockchain, and any transactions that happen on the Stacks blockchain are summarized on the Bitcoin blockchain. So Stacks gets the security from the Bitcoin blockchain in that sense. There's a mechanism about how do you summarize it and how do you ensure that it cannot be gamed and all of that stuff. They have something called proof of transfer, not proof of work, which is what Bitcoin has, not proof of stake, which is what Ethereum has. But they have a different concept called proof of transfer, where that's the mechanism that they use to ensure that the Stacks blockchain is tied to the security of the Bitcoin blockchain. So all transactions on the Stacks blockchain inherit the security of the Bitcoin blockchain in that sense.
And yeah, and you know, I know that economics wasn't something that got you interested. You're more of a technologist, which is kind of where I'm at with this, is, you know, the token value is kind of detached from the reality of what's being built often. So, but you know, in your opinion, Stacks obviously has a token. They decided they wanted their own token, I guess, to fundraise their project or pay people within the ecosystem of this, you know, of builders of Stacks. But if it's rolling up to Bitcoin and then the Bitcoin blockchain, do you think those are correlated, I guess, the Stacks token or what's happening there to the overall value of Bitcoin? And do you think this like application layer almost to Bitcoin is something that is net positive for everyone, or kind of how is that relationship between the two entities?
So you see, the Stacks token is also needed actually to sort of gatekeep, sort of pay for the various operations that happen on the Stacks blockchain, right? It's the same concept that you have on Ethereum. If you don't have a token, yes, they also use the token for bootstrapping and all that stuff. But if you don't have the token, then it can be free for all. You can have a lot of DOS attacks and everybody wants to have all these transactions. But as soon as you have the token, you are somehow controlling the valid transactions from the DOS related transactions. So Stacks uses the STX token for the purpose of controlling these. It's like the gas fees. It's like the transaction fees on the Stacks blockchain.
Yeah, it's a security almost. I was just curious if you why that, you know, they needed their own token versus just kind of running it on Bitcoin, since it seems like it is so dependent on Bitcoin. But I guess you're saying it's, you know, it would be kind of unsustainable, right, to run this on Bitcoin. Is that why?
So one of the things they are working on, I think they have a solution to this currently. There are some solutions that I need to dive into in detail. But Bitcoin itself, they got to lock it up on the Bitcoin blockchain, and then they got to have some token that works on the Stacks blockchain. Mm. Bitcoin itself, I mean, yeah, you can, when you lock up Bitcoin in the Bitcoin blockchain, you need to have some token. For example, I lock up one Bitcoin on the Bitcoin blockchain, give me some tokens that represent that on the Stacks blockchain. So they had not figured that out initially, so they started out with their own token, I believe. That's my understanding. And now they are trying to get some sort of one-to-one mapping between the Bitcoin token, in some sense. Bitcoin is a token, Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency, and some other token called SBTC that they are looking at, another token on the Stacks blockchain. And I need to understand, this was a proposal that came out just about a month back or less than a month back. So I need to spend some time looking at it. But Stacks has been the initial token that they use just to make things simpler, as well as the kickstarting part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I guess, you know, the reason I'm curious about this is because often in the space, you'll hear the term Bitcoin maxis, right? And this is something me and you have talked about before. These people, and I don't even say these people, but just groups of users that essentially think there is one chain, the Bitcoin blockchain, which should be used over all other chains. And it is the most secure, it's the best, it's, you know, the ultimate end game of money, and that everything else is just kind of, I guess, noise or distraction, or not, you know, useful for the vision of what Bitcoin blockchain is trying to build, which is, you know, a decentralized money system. I guess kind of how is the relationship then between Stacks, which is very much, it seems, not coherent to this vision, right? Or am I missing something?
No, Stacks, the Bitcoin maxis don't like the Stacks chain, the Stacks blockchain. So, yeah, although the goal of Stacks is to enhance the capabilities of Bitcoin to make Bitcoin more valuable, but still, because it's a separate token, they had the initial pre-mining and all of that stuff. Those are some of the things that I believe do not gel well with the Bitcoin, so-called Bitcoin maxis.
Gotcha. Well, let's kind of reframe this a little bit then. I kind of want to learn more about you and your experience teaching on the college campus as well as online. You're very, you know, qualified professional. So I'm just a little bit interested, what brought you to teaching? And then why did you kind of start teaching about cryptocurrencies or blockchains, probably more specifically? And kind of what's been your experience on campus as well as online teaching? Feel free to take the question any direction you'd like.
Sure. I mean, teaching is something that I've been quite interested in. Even after getting my PhD, I joined a research lab. But during those times also, I was on the East Coast for several years. And I used to teach at a couple of universities, UPenn, Rutgers, and Stevens. Of course, then I was an adjunct professor. I was teaching different courses, especially in the domain of cybersecurity. Those were the courses that I used to teach during those days. Then I moved over to the West Coast for a couple of years, especially with the startup life and all of that stuff with my own startup. Did not have time to do that. But I strongly believe in education, Jake. I mean, and now going on to crypto, crypto is a different, quote unquote, way of life. It's going to be the, I strongly believe, that's my opinion, it's going to be the basis of the next internet revolution. You see, the first internet revolution was fueled by the World Wide Web. The next one, in my opinion, was because of the social media. The third one was because of the mobile devices, then the cloud. And now, I strongly believe crypto is well positioned to be the basis of the next internet revolution. And it's a different way of doing things. That's one part of it. The second part of it is I strongly believe in education, as to repeat what I said earlier. So I'm just combining them both. And I got a chance to be part of Harrisburg University. And that's where I have been teaching several courses at Harrisburg University. We have about 5 different courses in the domain of blockchains, crypto, basically about bitcoins, Ethereum, decentralized finance, the regulatory aspects of it, as well as about scalability and all that. 5 different courses to cover all aspects of blockchains and crypto, because again, this is going to be the basis of the next internet revolution.
Gotcha. And I'm curious, by the way, where'd you get your PhD?
I got my PhD from University of Maryland, College Park.
Okay, nice. I'm also a former attendee of UMD. They have a great, they actually have a good blockchain program. So just to reframe this though, Harrisburg is an interesting choice because often, you know, when you hear about this space, you know, you hear about the big players, right? There's Harvard, Stanford, these programs are really tech forward. These are really smart students. And they have like pretty robust, right, blockchain clubs. Some of them are part of BAF, some of them are not. And the smaller schools I always was concerned about, especially when I go guest lecture here in South Carolina or Florida or wherever it is, I was always concerned, would they get it? Like, would people in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania actually get why blockchain or what value this has? Or would it just be something that just seems very buzzwordy, very risky, and not something you'd want to spend you know, your college money and time studying? I guess, what's been the reception from your end, or have you seen the students engage on campus or in your classes?
So at Harrisburg, the leadership at Harrisburg understands the potential of blockchains and bitcoins and all of that stuff. And they have been quite supportive in terms of the various courses that we have. That's one part of it, Jake. And the second part of it is even the students at Harrisburg, I mean, these blockchain courses, they have a quote unquote a full house in some sense. I mean, we have a 20, 30 students. I mean, the max is about 20, 25 students that we allow in the class. Sometimes I have seen about 40, 50 students in the class. So the point is a lot of students at Harrisburg, I think they see the potential. And this is even with the crypto winter. I'm not talking about maybe about a year back when we had the crypto spring or crypto summer and stuff like that. But even in the winter now, people understand, yes, it might be the winter, but things are going to turn around and this is going to be the basis of the next internet revolution. And maybe I'm a good teacher along with my colleague out there. Sorry, I just had to say that, Jay.
Of course. No, I'm sure you are. And I guess kind of on that same, do you have to like sell your class on campus? Like, do you have to explain to other professors or students what DeFi is or why a blockchain and Ethereum blockchain are different, or Bitcoin and Ethereum blockchain are different? Or is this something that, you know, there's just natural curiosity kind of around campus? What's been your kind of experience on that?
There has been a natural curiosity, especially 12 months back, right? With Bitcoin going to $60,000 and Ethereum going to $4,000, and everybody is, and their grandpa were buying Bitcoin and Ethereum. There was natural curiosity from those days. And we had structured the program such that you have a basic course, and then you had this advanced course on DeFi and stuff like that. So I guess the structure of the quote unquote, the blockchain program, blockchain concentration, as we call that, I have another colleague of mine, the two of us, we teach at the blockchain, part of the blockchain program. But I guess the way we have structured the concentration also helps, because somebody who's curious can come into the very basic beginner's course. And then I have seen many, they go on and they take these other courses on the regulatory aspects of it or on the DeFi aspects of it or whatever.
How many courses? You said 5 total courses?
There are 5 total courses as part of the blockchain concentration.
Okay, and this is a minor or a major?
It's a major.
Okay, wow. And you can take this online or just on campus?
Well, it's a combination. You have some courses that are online. There are some courses that you need to be on campus.
Gotcha. So I guess to that same regard, you know, you're someone who deeply believes and sees the value of decentralization, right? When third parties start to get abusive. How do you think this reflects, I guess, in the world of college and higher ed? Do you think as a online educator, someone who me and you met through an online education platform, do you think that there will be less and less kind of controls to curriculum and access to these educational programs? Or how do you see this kind of playing out over the next 5 years, maybe?
So let me see whether I understand your question. Your question is more along the lines, I mean, you're focusing just on the online education, or are you focused more on the crypto aspects of the online education?
Well, I guess kind of both, but I kind of want to first hear what your view is as someone who's actively a college professor and actively teaches online. Like, I assume in some ways the courses and the content and you are similar, right? But one of them requires you to go through this degree, right? And it's a centralized authority, and one of them is just somewhat decentralized, right? They pay you and you kind of teach them, and so on and so forth. I guess kind of, do you see the value of the authority within education, within that, as opposed to just direct education, decentralized education, whatever you'd like to call it? Does that make more sense, I guess? Yeah.
Yeah. So there are advantages and disadvantages to everything is what I would say, Jake. For example, the centralized university-focused education also brings its own cohort. So in these classes of mine, I mean, I could as well as create a course and put it on Udemy or Coursera or whatever have you, and you could go through the course by yourself and you have to learn by yourself. You don't have a cohort, you don't have a group of people that can help you with their learnings also, so that it's a networking effect. The university gives you the networking effect also. You are learning with a cohort of 10, 20, 30 people. And now the way I structured my classes also, we also have group activities in the class where people are interacting with each other. That's something that you don't have on Udemy. You're just downloading a course and you're learning by yourself. There's nobody to motivate you. There's nobody to demotivate you. There's nobody for you to learn from. Those are some of the things that might not be present in a completely decentralized video courses only. The universities, if they structure this properly, they can get the advantage of collecting a group of people with similar standards who are interested in similar topics and different experiences that they have had in their past life. You might have an experience in the finance world. I might have had an experience in the technology world. And then now we are learning the same topic of Bitcoin that influences finance, technology, all these different things. And I would tell you, this is how I look at Bitcoin, and this is my way of looking at Ethereum or whatever have you. And you might have your own opinion on that. So if I make the classes in these universities as just lectures with a dialogue, not even a dialogue, just a monologue from me, and you're listening to me all the time, then I am not taking advantage of the platforms that the university provides. I, as an instructor, need to ensure that I take advantage of the platform that the university provides to ensure efficient transfer of knowledge. Because ultimately, what is it? It's efficient transfer of knowledge. You want to learn something in education? You want the knowledge to be transferred efficiently into your brain from my brain and the other brains. So every platform has its own advantages. You need to take advantage. Every platform has its own positives. You need to take advantage of these positives to ensure efficient transfer of knowledge to the students. With universities, you have this group of people that can help you with the efficient transfer of knowledge in a different way. Of course, the downside with the universities are you got to be online at that time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Eastern. Sometimes you are caught in meetings, especially if you are working part-time or full-time or whatever have you. Those are some of the downsides with these cohort-based courses that you need to be on. You need to be synced up as far as time is concerned. So if that's a big constraint, which might be for some people, then maybe for them, the best thing is to look at courses on Udemy so that they can watch these courses 12 midnight one day, 4 a.m. morning the other day, 4 p.m. the next day, and so on and so forth, according to their own timing convenience.
Yeah, so I guess I'll concede, and because I'm playing a little devil's advocate here, I think community building, which is what you're referring to, mm-hmm. is something universities do an awesome job with, right? Like bringing different people together, getting them in a room, and under a unified goal, right, to learn. I think where I struggle with the university model or college model is that you as the professor are accountable, right? To not be doing the monologues and to make sure there's an efficient transfer of knowledge, an engaging transfer of knowledge. I guess, how do you think that can be held accountable? Because it seems like once you're kind of in for your degree, you kind of prepay for 4 years of lectures, right? And you're kind of gambling on whether those lectures are going to be a transfer of knowledge. So I guess, how do you see that maybe a problem being solved, or how do you address that?
That indeed is a problem. And one way that students can address that is by looking at, quote unquote, the reputation of the universities, the reputation of the departments within the universities, talk with other people who have already been students at that university, and maybe the university also needs to look at the feedback that the students provide during the courses that the students already take, and try to ensure that the professors on the university's platform are taking advantage of the positives that the university platform provides. Otherwise, it's a waste of time. And the university will not survive in the long run too, right? I mean, if the platform, the advantages of the university platform are not being taken advantage of by the professors who are on the university platform, well, what happens? The enrollments will start declining. People will start, man, that's not a good university. So the university leadership also needs to keep it in mind. So it's a combination of both. Students will have to look at the feedback and all that stuff before they decide on the good universities, good courses, good instructors. And the university leadership has to ensure that the professors, the instructors on the university platform are taking advantage of it. So it needs to happen on both sides. And of course, the professors or the instructors themselves, they also need to have this in mind, that I need to take advantage of the positives of the platform, of the good things, of the good features of the platform to ensure efficient transfer of knowledge. So it's a combination. Gotcha. It can't be done in, at least my opinion, difficult just for one party to do it. It's a combination. The students have to do their job. The university leadership has to do its job. The professors have to do their job. And if everybody is focused on efficient transfer of knowledge, then that will help you achieve your objective. And by the way, one thing I strongly believe in, Jake, is education also needs to be entertaining now. I mean, the days of, I have been sitting in classes when I was a student where the lecturer would drone on and on and on, and I had no choice. I was just sitting there listening to it, wasting 90 minutes of my lifetime and stuff like that. And online education helps with that. Think about it. I am reaching the students for my online classes, and YouTube is just one click away for these students.
Yeah.
Okay. So I need to make myself entertaining. I mean, students, why are they registered for classes? They want to learn. But if I am droning in such a fashion that I'm putting them to, making them go to sleep, making them drowsy, then they can switch on to YouTube or TikTok or whatever is the latest craze of the day at that point in time.
Yeah, the attention wars are crazy. I was teaching this class about 3 months back, and it's just, you know, especially when you're not part of the university system and there's not like a high fee behind the class, right? And they're just kind of coming, and you're just fighting for eyeballs. And it's a hard war, I think, in mm-hmm. education. So, but no, I really like the way you described it. Very elegant to kind of look at all these stakeholders, all these parties that have to trust one another, right? You know, the teachers, the admin, the students, and do kind of reputation management. It almost sounds like a protocol in some ways.
But, right, yeah.
So I kind of wanted to rapid fire to wrap up here today and just talk to you a little bit about the year coming up. We're at the beginning of 2023. So first question I have is just any bold predictions or thoughts about things you're very confident will flesh out in 2023 or things you're excited about in 2023?
I am, especially in the crypto world, I'm quite bullish about Ethereum and the scalability. And if you had asked me this question early 2022, I was not as positive about Ethereum, but with the whole merge and all these other things, diving deeper, the DeFi ecosystem and the various problems that exist on Ethereum, especially with respect to the scalability, stuff like that, we will see a lot of improvements in that space. And DeFi itself is a space, decentralized finance itself is a space that I'm quite excited about as far as 2023 is concerned.
Gotcha. Any specific projects or things you want to plug that you're excited about?
There are several ones that I'm looking at. I would rather not point out any explicitly, or maybe I will. I mean, the whole space of lending, borrowing, the perpetual swaps and stuff like that, those are of interest for me, as well as the decentralized exchanges. Those are some of the interesting areas in the DeFi space that I'm currently looking at.
Gotcha. And anything else you want to, you know, plug or promote, or anything else you're interested in 2023?
Yeah, I mean, definitely our own Leos platform, where we are working on adding more courses to Leos platform so that people, they learn about the concepts, they learn about quizzes. But unlike many other courses, we will give you exercises and we can verify on the chain in an automatic fashion whether you have done those exercises correctly or not. And based on passing the course with multiple modules, you can mint your own NFT and all that stuff that happens for the existing single course called Stacks. But we are quite excited about expanding the platform and adding more courses onto the Leos platform, more courses with on-chain verification. That's something that I'm quite excited about. And the third thing that I'm also planning to focus on is maybe write some books for absolute beginners and maybe create some courses for absolute beginners in the crypto space. I already have one course on Udemy, as I mentioned, for Bitcoin and Ethereum for absolute beginners. But I plan to do the same thing in different areas like DeFi, specific areas of DeFi and stuff like that. I'm planning on the various different projects in addition to continuing to teach at Harrisburg.
Excellent. And if people want to follow you or get in contact, do you have a Twitter or anything you're active on?
Yes, I'm somewhat active, not very active, but somewhat active on Twitter. My handle on Twitter is blockchain092. Don't ask me why I decided. I thought blockchain was a good one. And why did I decide 092? I don't know, but blockchain092, that's where I am on Twitter. That would be the best place to follow me. I'm also on Discord, but DM me on Twitter and we can take the conversation beyond that if needed.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. It was awesome to get into Stacks and to learn about your experience in higher ed. And I'm super excited to kind of talk to you again. So have a good one and thanks for your time.
Thanks again for getting me on your platform, Jake. You have a nice day. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And there you have it. That was this week's episode of the BAF podcast. Again, please follow us on Twitter. We are the Blockchain Accelerator Foundation, as well as EduCoin NFT. We look forward to hearing from you online and in person as we continue to host events and put information out there. Again, keep building, stay strong, and we are always here to help. Thanks and have a good one.